today's book discussion is about the rise and fall of Adam and Eve. So now, I give you the brilliant Pulitzer Prize winning author, Stephen Greenblatt.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for being here. Wonderful that we're gathered together, first of all, in a morning that looks like it could have been a morning in paradise, and in this amazing ecclesiastical space. Somewhat intimidating to talk about Adam and Eve here, but I suppose if not here, where? The story of Adam and Eve, which is the subject of my book, is probably the most important, influential, imaginative creation in all of Western history. It was written down a long time ago, probably in the form that we know it around the 6th century before the Common Era, but it almost certainly dates from much earlier than that. Might have been written down as early as the 10th century before the Common Era, and before it was written down, it probably had a long life as an oral tale. So it goes back an enormously long time, and it was transmitted again and again and again by thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people who've repeated it over and over again to pass it from one generation to another until it reaches our own moment. It's an amazing creation, and at the center for me of my interest in the story, of course, is an enormous institutional history, an elaborate institutional history, but also just something about the story itself, which seems to be oddly radioactive. In a tiny, tiny compass, it's only a page and a half of an enormous text of the Bible. In a tiny compass, it seems to explain almost everything. The origin of men and women, the dominance of our species, love and sex and reproductive desire, and the necessity to labor, pain in childbirth, male domination, female desire, mortality, even the fear of snakes, all compressed into this tiny space where they all seem to trace themselves back and receive some kind of explanation, an explanation for the history of our fears and our desires and our dreams of bliss and our deepest sense of shame. It's an amazing achievement in a tiny short story that has had this strange central life in the three great monotheisms in our world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. It is an origin story for all three of these religions, but it's not equally distributed, as it were, as a central story. For the Jews and for the Muslims, the story of Abraham, in some sense, Abraham and Isaac for the Jews, Abraham and Ishmael for the Muslims, sits at the foundation of the religion. And it was the Christians who took the Adam and Eve story from the Hebrews and established it as somehow crucial to understand if we're to understand the second Adam, Jesus. To understand the second Adam, we'd have to understand something about the first Adam. But in any case, all three monotheisms took this story, monogenetic story. We've all descended from the same two people as their central origin story. And that is the origin for me of the fascination of the book that I've written. And it was, for me, an extraordinary adventure and pleasure to write the book, but it had a central problem from a writerly point of view, which is how to keep any control over this, the immensity of the story. The story is tiny, but the consequences and the development of the story is immense. So it was part of the huge pleasure, but also the challenge of figuring out what to make of the story, what to leave out of the enormous interpretive tradition, and what to include. And perhaps in the conversation that Martha and I will have, we can talk a little bit about what choices go into constructing a story to tell, the story of this story. The simplest way to get at some of the challenges posed by this story would be that to tell you, or for those, some of you to remind you, that the earliest surviving trace of the story from the Nag Hammadi codices, which were dug up from the sands of Egypt, only discovered in 1946, but the date from the probably from the 3rd century and were probably written even earlier, so dating from 2,000 years ago, that trace was someone saying that the hero of the story was the woman. So already 2,000 years ago, there was an odd problem noticed in the story, or a question noticed in the story. Now, the reason that it was dug up in the sands was that this was an interpretation that didn't win. It was buried for 2,000 years. But it means that among the very earliest responders to the story that we have access to are people clearly who are interpreting it against the grain that we generally understand the story to go. And that's part of the excitement, the adventure of the enterprise of trying to understand the history of this story. There were people very early on, including people within the Christian world, most famously a bishop named Marcion, who was born in AD of the Common Era, so we're talking about a very, very early Christian, who thought that the story should be scrapped, that we don't need to live with the strange incoherences of this story, with the ethical problems that the story raises, that Christians would be better off without the whole baggage of what he thought was an incoherent Hebrew inheritance. Marcion also lost, and his followers were condemned, as he was, of heresy. But it means that the arguments began very early. And to some extent, those arguments have continued even into our present world, though in somewhat different form, obviously, where a significant number of, particularly of Americans, profess to believe in the literal truth of the story, while a very significant number of Americans think that the very idea of believing in the literal truth of the story is a sign of a very strange rejection of everything that the modern world, modern scientific understanding of the world, depends upon. So we're still at loggerheads over this story and over its meaning. I think I won't say more at this point about the plot that I have tried to describe, tried to tell, the story I've tried to tell about the story, but I will actually just turn things over to Martha to whom I'm enormously grateful, and who has been very busy in the last few days, if any of you have read the newspaper, and therefore all the more so that do I feel grateful for you for taking the time out of the entertaining of 6 of our Supreme Court justices and many other people in the anniversary of Harvard Law School to do this. So thank you, Martha, and I'll turn it over to you, and then we'll also have time to entertain questions from you.
Well, Stephen, it's such a thrill for me to be here. I'm such a fan of all of your work, but I have to tell everybody here, this is a page-turner. I could not put it down, and I can't believe that the book is over and I've started reading it again. So why don't we start where you actually dangled a very tantalizing idea, choices that you made, and the plot. So there is a story about the story, but there could have been many stories about the story. And that seems also related to the theme you've identified about commonalities across cultures, but you also go before the story begins. You find a pre-story. So tell us about the pre-story and then the choices that you made.
So the first thing maybe to say in response is that it seems to be a characteristic of our species to want to know where we came from, to ask the question about our origins. As far as we know, we're the only creatures who do this, though, of course, we don't have access to the conversations that whales might be having under the sea. But as far as we know, this is something that we do, and we do it almost immediately. That's to say, if those of you who have children know that this is the kind of question that already small children ask. And then the question doesn't die out. So the question continues into adulthood. Where do we come from? How did we get here? What can you learn if you dig back deeper and deeper and deeper till you find the beginning of it all? And that the reason that it's important to say that is that the Hebrew story, though I said that it's immensely old, is by no means the first or the only origin story. Virtually all cultures have them, as far as we know, and the Hebrews would have encountered other people's origin stories. And most specifically, for my purposes, though there are traces of many origin stories floating around in the Near East and in the Mesopotamian Delta, there was a particular moment. A moment in which the Hebrews, having made the wrong set of political choices, found themselves defeated and in exile in Babylon for almost a century. And they would certainly then, if not before, have encountered in a way that must not have been very agreeable, the Babylonian origin stories, which are extremely developed and very powerful. And by a kind of miracle, we have access to those stories, as we don't have access to many ancient origin stories. Their oral stories get lost. But in the case of the Babylonian stories, the defeat of those civilizations and the catastrophe that befell those civilizations, which usually wiped out everything, had a very strange effect in that part of the world, because their texts were written in clay, in cuneiform marks on clay. And when the palaces were burned and the libraries were torched and the civilizations were reduced to rubble, the palaces that burned became kilns. And they basically fired the tablets on which the ancient stories were written. And since clay tablets are worth nothing to anybody, no one hauled them off for any purpose. They were just left as garbage, basically, as rubbish under the heaps. So that in the 19th century of our era, when archaeologists began to dig looking for statues and jewelry, they began to find hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of these tablets, some of which contained these origin stories. And so we know now what the Hebrews heard when they were digging the irrigation ditches in Nineveh and Babylon, and what they were reacting against, and reacting also in relation to. So that's where I start. And if I can go on for 1 second more, the simple thing to get for you to get the sense of how fascinating this stuff is and what's at stake here is that the Babylonians had an origin story that also involved the creation of humans to work in the garden, but really to work in the garden, to dig ditches, to do the work that the junior gods had to do and that they didn't want to do anymore. So the senior god comes up with a brilliant idea of creating these humans to do the work, and it's a spectacular success. But the trouble is that humans reproduce. Well, it's not trouble. It's good that they reproduce because you get more generations of workers. But as you may have noticed, humans are noisy when they reproduce. I don't mean when they reproduce, but their infants are noisy. And the god, the senior god, can't sleep in the afternoon. He wants to rest. And the squalling of all of those humans is annoying him. So he decides to destroy them. And that, for the Babylonians, was the origin of all our woes, of the plagues and the fires and ultimately the huge flood. So that the Hebrews clearly were thinking about this story. What is the origin of our misery? Why do we have to labor? Why do we suffer? Why do we die? And they had, as it were, ready-made in Babylon, a fantastic explanation for this, because God wants to sleep in the afternoon and we keep disturbing him. But it's not our fault. It's just because you can't blame infants for screaming. It's a story that is like ours, but not like ours, ours being the Hebrew origin story. So the Hebrews came up with this astonishing variation in which God doesn't need help to sleep. If he feels like taking a rest, he'll take a rest, but in which the same set of problems is attributed to a choice that human beings have made, apparently, a violation of a prohibition.
Which does introduce fault. And so let's dive into maybe one of the most controversial aspects, which is Eve. And is Eve to blame? And are there other versions? How do we interpret it? Is Eve the heroine? You mentioned something about that. Is the snake to blame?
The snake, by the way, was also proposed very, very early on, several thousand years ago, that the snake was the hero of the story. Both explanations implying that the god of the story was the wicked one. That is to say, the story has perplexed people for a long time. But one way in which people resolved the perplexity for a very long time was to say, yes, the woman is the one at fault. Because in the Bible account, the biblical account, it's the woman who has the conversation with the serpent and the woman who makes the first move of taking the fruit of the tree that she's been prohibited from eating and eating it and then giving it to her husband. So the rabbis asked very early on, when Eve had the conversation, when the woman had the conversation with the serpent, where was the man? And there were a variety of explanations. Some rabbis, ancient rabbis, thought, well, maybe they had made love, had had sex, and the man was sleeping after sort of post-coital nap while Eve was having the conversation with the serpent. Or perhaps he was walking around the garden looking at his property and let the woman have the conversation. But as the story developed, and particularly within the Christian tradition, blame began to fall increasingly on the woman. And it was easy enough for the, especially Christians who came from a Gentile background, that is to say from Greek and Roman background, to use the story of Pandora, to use other elements of Greek and Roman misogyny, and apply it to the woman. Because early Christians were not necessarily or routinely misogynistic. The earliest Christians welcomed women
as equals.
So it was a very unusual move in early Christianity, and not at all characteristic of that the world of late antiquity. But then, fairly early on, by about the fourth century of the Common Era, the blame begins to point increasingly to the woman, though not exclusively so. But many, many, especially men, you won't be surprised to learn, thought that that must be the answer to this story.
Well, one reason, as you've already started to hint, that the story is so generative is that it admits of many interpretations. And you uncover one in which Eve is the heroine. So how can she be the heroine of this story?
She could be the heroine of the story if you believe that, first of all, if you believe that knowledge is better than not having knowledge, and that the world is full of warnings not to know, but the only way forward is to know, and to, therefore, if necessary, to transgress in order to achieve knowledge. And specifically, this story has a twist in it that was noticed from the beginning. This is not the result of skepticism of the 21st century, but this is an ancient perception. The story centers on a prohibition. The god puts the humans in the garden, says that they're vegetarians, they can eat any of the fruits vegetables growing in the garden, except for the single prohibition, they must not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, lest they die. But it was pointed out very early on that the God neglected to explain what he means by lest you die, so that humans would have had very little ability in a world without death, evidently, to know what death is. And I sometimes imagine, in fact, the man is thinking, who gets this warning originally, thinking, you know, I didn't really understand what that death thing was. I must ask him next time I have a conversation with him what he meant by that. In any case, the prohibition is about, the prohibition is from eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But again, it was noticed very early that without knowing the difference between good and evil, it would be impossible to observe the prohibition in any reliable way.
It's so ironic. They don't have the knowledge, so how could they have the knowledge to know that they shouldn't
exactly
get the knowledge? Right.
So this was in that sense, this was a story written by Franz Kafka. and if you...
A lawyer, by the way.
If you took the story in that spirit, you can see that you could come out relatively, it was a minority opinion, to
yes.
use a term from your world.
Yes.
But you could come out and say, no, it's the woman who is the hero
of
the story.
Well, very much one of the very fascinating parts of the ironic journeys that you tell here is this movement between seeing Adam and Eve as fictional literary characters versus real people, our actual ancestors. So who helped to make us understand Adam and Eve as real, and who challenged that?
Yes,
and
that's my whole plot, Martha. And though it's probably a violation of my publisher's rules, I'll tell you the plot of the story, which is, at least as I came up with it, and these things are always debatable, like everything. Early on, there are many records of allegorical, philosophical interpretations of the story of Adam and Eve. As I probably don't have to tell you, the people who lived back then were no more or less credulous than we are. They say it's a mistake to think that, oh, way back then they were so stupid and believed everything. They were no more or less than we are. They got, at least a significant number of people got from the beginning, that a story about a naked man and a woman and a talking snake in a magical garden with strange trees was not immediately believable as a scientific origin story for humanity. So that is to say, many people understood it quite early on to be a myth or a parable, so that you get a very significant number of Jews and of Christians treating the story as intellectuals go ahead and love to treat stories of this
symbolism
kind, as they treat stories
yes.
from Plato or sure. whatever, and doing the things that intellectuals do with parables or myths. So figures like Philo in the Hebrew tradition, or Origen in the Christian tradition, these are the big key players in this, but there are many, many players of this kind. And then it's not till fairly late, in effect, until the 5th century, that a super sophisticated intellectual, namely Augustine, made a decision, but it took him a long time and a struggle in his life of a, to me, totally fascinating kind. He made the decision that, no, it was crucially important to take the story ad literam, as he says, literally. It has to be, we have to understand the story not as fancy intellectuals doing subtle philosophical interpretations, but we have to start with the notion that Adam and Eve were real people in the real world, and we build from that understanding of their reality. And there was a fight about this possibility.
That's
fascinating. Augustine was both a brilliant intellectual and a brilliant institutional player, and he won, and he set the course and effect of Christianity to take the story literally. And it took about 1,000 years to succeed in somehow making them real that way. It's hard to do, unbelievably hard to do. And making them real means that you ask all kinds of questions, because they meant real. Did they digest their food? If they digested their food, did they shit? If so, did that mean that paradise was full of shit? I mean, I'm not making this up. These are stories they ask. And then, did it smell? Luther says, no, it didn't. It was full of shit, but it didn't smell. and so forth. When all the creatures were created from the beginning, did God make fleas? There's a medieval expression, Adam had 'em. Meant he had fleas. I mean, it took a long time to answer all the questions that needed to be answered.
Well, and one of the group of people who tried to answer it were artists. So much of the book also includes tremendously fascinating discussions of visual depictions of this story, some of which go very realistic.
Yes.
Which of those visual depictions did you find most arresting?
I mean, that's the we have, as a species, we have people who specialize in making things real, making representations real. And those are our artists, our sculptors, our painters, our poets. And so we have an enormous, fabulous record of this grappling with the problem of how to represent these creatures. So I mean, among the innumerable figures of this kind, I mean, it's hard to know where to go, but I'll say one very early and one late image. One very early image, the earliest one that I can think of, is that I encountered, and it may be the earliest surviving representation of Adam and Eve, is in a catacomb in Rome, catacomb to Saints Marcellino e Paolo. So you go underground in a mediocre neighborhood in Rome, and you are suddenly in the world of the dead. And you're surrounded by images of the good news, Jonah escaping from the whale's mouth, Noah popping up like a jack-in-the-box from the ark, and Daniel in the lion's den. And then the figure of Adam and Eve. But Adam and Eve are hunched over, ashamed, miserable, and abject. So this is from a world in which, this is very, very early on, third century of the Common Era. This was a world in which the Christians, when they came up out of the catacomb into the sunlight, would have seen the naked bodies of the Roman athletes and gods. But they chose to represent the first humans as miserable in their shame. And that, in a way, set a kind of precedent for a long ancient and medieval representation of Adam and Eve, not to represent them as, how should we say, real figures in our sense, but as emblems of misery and of shame. And it's only fairly late in the Middle Ages and then in the Renaissance, that Adam and Eve get the bodies of magnificence,
Adonis,
Apollo, and they literally get the figures of Apollo because they begin to dig up ancient sculptures, and they begin to think again in the Renaissance of people like Michelangelo or Titian, Dürer begin to think about what the ancient artists thought that the perfect human body looked like. And they use that as the model for what the perfect humans look like in paradise. So my single instance of a great or important Renaissance image would be a famous 1504 copperplate engraving by Dürer of Adam and Eve, based on figures of Venus and of Apollo, but now set in the garden. And they're magnificent. Adam is particularly magnificent. And it's catching them just at the moment before disaster happens. So the moment at which their bodies are perfect, and yet in a nanosecond, it's all going to change. So Dürer's image for that is that Adam has his foot lightly resting on the tail of a mouse. The mouse doesn't seem to be noticing, doesn't hurt the mouse, but Adam's foot is on a mouse's tail. And there's a very large cat who's looking kind of interested at the mouse, but nothing has happened yet. But we know that in a split second, Adam will reach for the apple, he'll move his foot, he'll taste, and the mouse will be toast. so we're seeing what the world looked like just before. And that image was circulated, was sold throughout Europe, so that thousands of people thought for the first time, now we know what Adam and Eve looked like when they were still innocent.
The first frozen frame.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. How then did Adam and maybe Eve become American? What did Mark Twain do? What did Walt Whitman do?
Americans, of course, were tremendously drawn to Adam and Eve because of a fascination with a pristine world, with the possibility of getting back somehow to that moment in which everything was fresh and new, and in which our bodies were what they should have been had we not sinned, and in which shame has dropped away. And in effect, the great figure of shamelessness of this kind was Walt Whitman, who very much writes about himself as Adam urging, desiring, in effect, to be naked before everyone and urging people to touch him, to embrace him, but to embrace him as the American Adam, in effect. And Adam and Eve in the garden have a huge presence in the American imagination in the 18th and 19th centuries. But, of course, America, which generally tends to take things to an extreme in all directions, takes that kind of embrace of the innocence to an extreme, and it also takes the critique to an extreme. So you get Mark Twain brilliantly writing diaries for Adam and Eve and simultaneously mocking the story in a wicked, very funny way, but also more than mockery, trying in effect to drive a knife into what he takes to be the cruelty of the story, its underlying viciousness.
And he didn't want them published during his lifetime.
Well, his family objected to them. He was also very canny about where he might finally step too far in terms of his reputation and sales. so some of them he actually held on, the most bitter ones he held on to. But even the Eve's Diary, which was published during his lifetime, with very sweet, rather innocent little line drawings, they look like they're done in the New Yorker, was banned by the Worcester Public Library as obscene. So he's already getting close to the line at the time.
I hope I don't spoil anything, because everyone should read this book, but you do, towards the end, describe visiting chimpanzees in their homes. And why did you do that? How does evolution, how does Darwin, how does the study of large mammals figure in this book and in this narrative?
I mean, the first thing to say is that I'm one of those people who does not believe in the literal truth of the story of Adam and Eve, but maybe you intuited that anyway. That is to say, I am the inheritor and the believer of the scientific origin story that traces itself back to 18th and 19th century geology, to the moment in the early 19th century in which people began to realize that the Earth was a lot older than
the story suggests.
The Bible had suggested. The general consensus from the Bible, counting generations in the Bible, was that the world was created in 4004 before the Common Era. But it was realized in the 19th century that 6,000 years was not enough time for the world to have reached its current state. And then Darwin, in effect, hammered the nail into the coffin. So the origin story, the scientific origin story, traces us back to what is called, I love this, the LCA. The LCA is the last common ancestor. And the last common ancestor is, it is thought, most resembles, in our current world, most resembles chimpanzees. We're not descended from chimpanzees, but there were, if, at the branching, which took place a very long time ago, the last common ancestor was, it's thought, for reasons I've learned and I could explain to you, more likely to be like a chimpanzee. We are currently 98.7% chimpanzees in our genes, so we're pretty damn close anyway. But we have a very small, we have that little extra 1.3% that does turn out to make a bit of a difference. So we can take planes together, go on an airplane together, which chimpanzees can't do.
Write books.
So I wanted, look, I was desperate to try to see for myself. This book is filled with the fantasy, at least, of making it real, seeing what it actually was. That's what all of my people, the people that I love in this book, spent their lives trying to do. Milton and Dürer and Augustine. What actually did it look like? What was it like there? And the closest we can get is to see chimpanzees in the wild. And so I was able, through a colleague at Harvard who has spent his life studying chimpanzees and created a remarkable research station in Western Uganda to see for myself what it was like. And it's extraordinary.
So primatology confirm or refute the story of Adam and Eve?
It's a good question. It doesn't look like Michelangelo or Dürer thought it looked. So to that extent, the primatology disproves that. And there's actually, insofar as it goes all the way back, there are many things that are not, that are disturbing and upsetting in relation to the story. It's true that chimpanzees are largely vegetarians, but not completely. If they can catch a monkey every once in a while, they eat it. It's true that they live in general in their groups in great harmony, but only with an elaborate status hierarchy in which the lower ranking males do a lot of pant grunting to the senior male, and in which the senior male slaps everyone around, and particularly the females around. So the answer is no, it doesn't really look like the biblical account, but in some profound way, it's very much like it. That is to say, as far as we can tell, they live without the knowledge of good and evil.
No shame.
They absolutely live without shame, as I can tell you. Oh, man, do they live without shame. And they don't seem to know that they're going to die. So that puts them in the world that actually has a strange resonance with the dream that the people who created this story must once have had.
I have a few more questions and I'll ask them, but start thinking of your own, and in a minute I will invite you to come up to this microphone. One question I have is, what is the actual Garden of Eden? Is there one? Is there a place on earth that makes you think this is the Garden of Eden, or that anyone thinks that there really is?
I'd love to turn this question back on you and on you. Maybe we could find, actually, if we put our heads together, some place we'd all desperately want to visit. Truthfully, I mean, I can conjure up various Caribbean beaches and so forth and so on, but honestly, in my heart, I like to embrace the places that I live in and love now. Maybe they're not quite Eden, Cambridge, Massachusetts, or Halifax, Vermont, where we have a place we go to, but they're what I want. They correspond to my desires. And I'm not sure one actually should go hunting for something else. There's a long history, of course, of people hunting for that place in many, many, many parts of the world. Yes. And if you look at old maps, you often see paradise marked in various places in the Near East, in what's now Persia sometimes, in Central and South America. And of course, if you look at one of those advertising supplements on vacations in various places that you get in the newspaper, they're always advertising Eden. But I hope for myself, and I hope for all of us, that we can find it actually fairly locally.
But that is one of the ways in which the story endures, that is that we're looking for paradise. Yes. In some way. No, that's very beautiful. Well, please come up if you have a question. Here's one more for you. How did you make the story so readable and so gripping? Because it's incredibly learned. It covers, as you can tell, literature, art, science, history, and yet it's a page-turner. How did you do that?
Well, you're very kind. And I'm not at all sure that I couldn't make good on that compliment. But if there is something to it, I would say two things. One is that I learned over a long time that there, for me, for what matters, there's no difference between what I'd want to say to my most, my most sophisticated graduate students and colleagues and to try to impress them, and what I'd want to say to the most ordinary person who hadn't spent a life in the library. That is to say, I hate the distinction that arose in my world between those things that you work on seriously as a scholar and those things that are meant for a broad
general
public
audience.
I think this has been a destructive distinction and very bad for the humanities, for my discipline. So I have actually spent quite a bit of my time over the last years trying to break down that barrier.
Oh, that's really great. Really great. Yes. And would you introduce yourself and go ahead with your question?
It sure is intimidating walking up here, I'll tell you.
Think about what we feel. Come on.
You're pros. My name is Jonathan. First of all, just as you said, you're wondering where Eden is. I assume it's being 4 years old and having loving parents, but that's just my answer.
Yeah.
But my question was, you said that the chimpanzees you saw had no concept of death. And I would love to hear more about that. In particular, I've read stories about elephants who, when they see someone they knew dead, they stay around the body, they mourn it. There's various activities that happen when an animal that they know dies. And so I'm wondering, what do the chimpanzees do?
So first, in response to your first throwaway comment, there is a long and rich history, especially in the 17th century, of people saying exactly what you said, that paradise is, if you want to know what it was like to be Adam and Eve, look at your small children. There's actually a wonderful body of poetry written in the 17th century about exactly that. About the chimpanzees, first of all, let me quickly say I'm no primatologist. There is some record of primates carrying dead infants around, not discarding them immediately. So it's possible that indicates some unwillingness, in any case, to let go of a dead of the dead. That would suggest that there is, that I overstated what I wanted to say. Second thing to say is that it's extremely difficult to observe many things about primates in the wild. There have been very few observations of how primates deal with their own dead. With their own dead.
You want to say loved ones, don't you?
I want to say loved ones, but I'm not saying loved ones because they're not necessarily loved ones. The most remarkable account is by now he's himself dead, a Japanese primatologist who in Tanzania, who was desperate to actually see what happens when a primate dies, and even he, after a lifetime of trying to do it, failed to actually catch the moment. There is no record, no trace of primates doing what elephants are said to do, and what Neanderthals, for example, we now know did, which was to create a ritual or have some relation to the dead. As far as we know, primates don't, except with the exception of some mothers carrying primate babies around for a while after they're dead.
And us.
Yeah, and us. We are. That's. It used to be thought that we were unique, but now the findings, the Neanderthal findings, suggest that other hominins, at least, did the same thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Wonderful lecture, Professor. One thing that intrigued me was you made mention of this Babylonian god who likes to rest every afternoon, and in the biblical account, God decides to set aside one full day for resting, and I wonder if there's anything that you found in it that was intriguing, the fact that instead of being annoyed at humans disturbing his rest, he decides, we're all going to rest. You and I are going to rest.
Yes.
It's good.
Yes, I think what you've said is quite eloquent, and I think it's true I think it's important that the Hebrew God does not appear to be, he's troubled by many things about humans. I mean, after all, the Hebrew God, early in Genesis, that is to say, the Hebrew God who looks at the wickedness in the generation of Noah regrets what he's done. So the Hebrew God is represented as having feelings and responses to the humans. Regret is a very human response to, and what have I done?
Anger.
He's also angry, yeah. That's true. But he doesn't have disturbed sleep. And which was a central motif for the Babylonians. And instead, I think what you said is right, that he institutes for, as a kind of collective, for himself, of course, he rests, but also he institutes for the Sabbath, and then, of course, in the even sabbatical year for the land, he institutes a kind of rest. But it's not, how should we say, defensive. It's not in response to the disturbance that humans are giving him. It's strange that the Hebrew God, for example, says it's not good for man to be alone.
Alone, yeah.
Couldn't he have thought of that from the beginning?
Yeah.
There's something about
he's
learning,
yes,
in the course of things, but not the rest. The rest he seems to undertake on his own.
I haven't read your book yet. I'm about to start. And I wonder, if we go back to this first condensed paragraph that was an inspiration for your book about Adam and Eve, we know that there was a shadow of another woman that precedes Eve. Her name is Lilith. And I wonder if she was a Hebrew invention or if there were Liliths in Babylonian tablets that you found. I also would like to know if you were ever at a junction of writing a story, Adam and Lilith, which would make it a totally different story because
yes,
Lilith was an equal or wanted to be an equal and she had been removed by
yes,
whom? By man, by God, by, you know, the story would be very different. So I wonder if you were ever tempted to write that story?
Yeah. It's a sequel.
A sequel.
I hope.
No. These are wonderful questions. The first thing to say is that there. I mean, Lilith, of course, is. I'm sure you will know in this room, does not appear in the Bible in the Genesis account. There are early traces of alternative stories, but not directly in the Bible. And there were, in the rabbinical tradition, there are a number of different alternative possibilities, including one in which, for example, in one story that the rabbis tell, God first created, the rabbis asked, why did God make the man go to sleep before he removed the rib and created the woman? And then the rabbis, ancient rabbis' account of this was, well, he tried a first time without putting the man to sleep. So he took the rib out and he made the woman, and the man was so, watched the operation, as it were, without being asleep, and he was so disgusted by what he saw, the viscera, the internal organs of human beings, and in this case of the woman, that he was unable to consummate the marriage, and God had to destroy the female and start again by putting him to sleep this time. So that is to say, that's not the Lilith story, but to say that the story is haunted by other possibilities from the beginning, that some of which we have access to, some of which we don't have access to. That's one, the Lilith story, the female who says, I'm not going to be dominated by you. I'm absolutely as good or better, is another possibility. And she, as you've already suggested, and there's a variety of different alternatives for how she gets destroyed, but she's warned terribly in one version of the story by the god that she'll suffer the consequences of her rebellion, and she rebels nonetheless, and the god destroys her offspring, drives her off, and she becomes a kind of figure that haunts human reproduction, so that she's responsible for the death of lots of infants. That's one version of the story to explain infant mortality, the extent of infant mortality. I want to say that the possibility of telling the story a different way, of having a different set of meanings, is one that does absolutely, that completely compelled me. The one that I wanted to tell was the, as an alternative, was not this, not the Adam Lilith story, though, particularly now in the wake of the news events of the last few weeks, one feels, yeah, maybe that would have been the good alternative account to tell. But I love the male buddy story, the Gilgamesh story, which is that everything really about the origin of human beings should have to do with two guys finding that they love each other and having a great time together and going on adventures. That is some movie from movie version, Hollywood movie version from
On the Road.
Yeah, On the Road. Kind of astonishing that was one very strong Mesopotamian alternative. In the case of Lilith, I'd want to say what interests me about Lilith is that not so much the Lilith story, but the fact that over the 2,000 years that the story has been interpreted, that we have access to, there have been many women who've resisted the misogynistic account and who've said, no, the account is a lie. There's another version of the story, not Lilith, but another version of the story buried in the story. And that story says that the man is made out of dirt. The woman isn't made out of dirt. The man is made outside of paradise. The woman is not made outside of paradise. The woman is made inside of paradise, and she's made out of a superior substance, namely bone, much better than dirt. And therefore, the woman is superior to the man, and it's a lie. The interpretation of the story has been a lie that says that the woman is inferior to the man. That's always haunted the story, and it came back, starting in the 17th century, really, it came back as a powerful argument, counter-argument to the misogynistic tradition. So there's always been that possibility, as it were, hidden in the story of the woman's voice refusing the misogynistic account. Yeah.
Last question.
Hi, I read The Swerve and just finished Adam and Eve. And what I love about your books are the personal stories that you start with that get me to always read the prologue, and then the change of the ideas over time in history. So I'm wondering if you have any personal hopes or academic projections for where these stories will be read in the next 1,000 years?
I'm not good at predicting 5 years in advance, let alone 1,000 years in advance. I do have a hope. Whether it's justified or not is another matter. The plot of my book, the history of my book, the history I want to trace in my book is the history in which an ancient creation of the imagination became for millions of people a piece of piety or orthodoxy. And that with an ongoing struggle, that story from really the 17th century on has begun to return, for many people at least, back to a piece of the human imagination. I think ultimately that's a hopeful story, a story in which in effect, orthodoxy and piety has been defeated by the freedom of the human imagination. I don't envisage, if I'm imagining the next 1,000 years, I don't want people to forget the story of Adam and Eve. I think the story of Adam and Eve is a stupendous achievement. But I want people to grasp what it means for human beings to have an imagination and to generate stories of this kind. And I believe in my heart of hearts that finally, at the end of the day, which is to say in 1,000 years, the human imagination is on the side of enlightenment and not on the side of repression. So I think that the part of the story that I believe in is the story that liberates humans from their fears and frees them to accept their responsibilities.
That's so beautiful. Thank you all.
Thank you.